From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM, emerging artist bumper music for you tonight for the first couple hours. And by the way, happy birthday to Tony Bennett, the great singer, 88 years old this Sunday. So later on tonight, his songs, too, just in tribute to him. And also, happy birthday to the member of the United States Coast Guard and two-time veteran of the Iraqi War, Iraq Joe from Seattle, Washington. Thank you, Joe, for your service. Appreciate everything you have done for this country. Here's what's happening. An American doctor infected with Ebola in Liberia seems to be improving, according to the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Kurt Brantley, the first known patient with the deadly virus, will be treated here on U.S. soil now. He landed at the Dobbins Air Reserve Base in Georgia on Saturday, was quickly rushed to Atlanta's Emory University Hospital. He is one of two Americans sickened by the deadly viral fever last month while on the front lines of a major outbreak in West Africa. He went out there. He donated his services to try to help people. He came down with Ebola. They flew him to the United States. Apparently, he gave him in Liberia a dose of an experimental serum. Let's see if that works. The second person out there will leave Liberia Tuesday, headed for the United States as well. In the United Kingdom, an Ebola terror at the Gatwick Airport as a passenger simply collapsed and died getting off a flight from Sierra Leone. She's 72 years old. Now, it's not clear whether she had Ebola or not, but man, they were panicking out there. Gary Ridenour, of course, is an expert on pandemics. Let's check in with him right now on this situation. Gary, I was opposed, still am, to bringing these Ebola victims into the country. But tell me about this apparent serum that they gave him in Liberia. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, apparently what they did, they gave him a unit of blood from a 14-year-old boy who survived. It's a primitive try to make a basis for a vaccine. The timing is very good because CDC says it's out of control there. The World Health Organization said it's moving faster than we can stop it. The epicenter now is 200 miles in diameter. But I think this coming week, the African Leadership Conference is being held in Washington with President Obama. And he'd be very happy to say that he's on the brink of finding a vaccine.
I'm not sure I'd be wanting of those to get in line to get a vaccine for this, Gary. Would you?
No, this is going to take years to work out. And even the African leaders that are coming in, all their assistants are going to be screened for Ebola before they come to see the president. This is going to have catastrophic loss of life and economic disruption in this area for decades.
As we watch this situation unfold with this patient who's here and the other who will be here on Tuesday, do you think the CDC is merely saying things like they're improving for public relations purposes?
Well, we know now that the Ebola is down. This Ebola may only have a 50 or 60% kill rate. So Dr. Brantley may be in that group that's in the survival group. So, you know, that is good. But the problem is that Nigeria has two people in isolation. They're watching very carefully right now. And they said from the plane flights and everything, there's a possibility of 30,000 people walking around with the potential of having Ebola.
Would you or would you not have flown him to the United States for treatment?
I thought it was a bad call. I don't know what we could do any better than what they're doing. I mean, he's getting IV fluids and trying to get nourishment to him, and that's practically what you can do for him. So it could be a possibility that they want a really good look at the virus and see if they can get some better ideas on what's going on with it.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Probably talk to you this week about this situation. A 68-year-old Illinois man is in jail charged with food tampering after he inserted sewing needles into packages of meat at a grocery store multiple times in the past year. six customers and one employee at a Shop and Save grocery in Belleville, Illinois, in suburban St. Louis, right across the Mississippi, reported finding needles in hamburger, roast, or steak products between May of 2013 and July 14 of this year. He owned a pickup bearing a disabled veteran license tag and shopped using a motorized scooter and oxygen tank, but surveillance videos caught him handling meat products and then putting them back on the shelves. The death toll has risen to 381 and 1,800 people injured after a strong earthquake hit China's Yunnan province. The area is a mountainous region known for its natural scenery and ethnic diversity, but it's also prone to natural disasters. Some 12,000 homes destroyed, 30,000 others damaged there. Israel has agreed to a seven-hour humanitarian ceasefire, according to the Israeli Defense Forces, but a spokesperson for Hamas, of course, says it's a no-go. The ceasefire expected to start right now. It would not apply to the areas in which Israeli soldiers are currently operating. Previous ceasefires have unraveled early. This one might not even get off the ground, as Hamas, of course, has not agreed to it. And yesterday, at least nine more people at a school died after it was being used as a shelter for about 3,000 people. They were killed in early morning shelling. Let's check in now with Jerry Corsi, of course, author of WorldNet Daily and also noted books. Jerry, again, the situation here, even though I think Israel has every right to do what it has to do to Hamas, the PR campaign is not working well for them.
Well, typically the Hamas gains the support of the United Nations, and clearly the civilian casualties being incurred in Gaza are a concern around the world. It looks like Israel pulled back on Sunday some of its forces out of Gaza, but I think we have to consider that a redeployment. I don't think Israel's finished yet with the offensive until they complete the destruction of this tunnel network, and I expect that Monday and Tuesday the fighting will resume.
Jerry, I got to say, somebody was asleep at the wheel in Israel to let all those tunnels get built, and they didn't even know about it.
It's incredible. When you see the network and the pictures that are coming out of these elaborate tunnels that a person can stand up in and concrete reinforced and the like, I mean, these tunnels are a massive network that allowed Hamas terrorists to, in a sense, pop up in Israel, and a major offensive was planned for the Jewish New Year in September. So this offensive was really a preemptive attempt to get rid of this tunnel network, and I think Israel intelligence was quite surprised at how extensive the network actually was.
Unbelievable. Jerry, talk with you this week, okay?
Yes. Thank you,
Dory. Jerry Corsi writes for WND.com. In the news, you can see the story. Officers didn't have to issue a speeding ticket when they spotted a giant tortoise walking down or ambling down a street in suburban Los Angeles. The Alhambra Police Department joked on its Facebook page that the 150-pound reptile was captured Saturday afternoon after a very brief and slow pursuit. Police are asking anyone with a big tortoise that went missing this weekend to simply contact them. It truly is bizarre. And if you go to our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com, look at the story there of a UFO caught on video in Milan, Italy. Huge. Huge UFO, mysterious lights emitting from some kind of UFO because it's unidentified. But you can see it all at coasttocoastam.com. Amazing story. Not too long ago, there was no coming back from death. But now a little electricity applied to the heart in just the right way at the right time apparently has changed all that. In a moment, we'll be talking with Dr. Dave Casseret, shocked on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you about our guest for the first couple hours here, Dr. Dave Casseret, physician, researcher, tenured professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. His studies have included more than 10,000 patients and have resulted in more than 100 articles and book chapters published in leading medical journals. He is the author of Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, which is an amazing book. Dave, first of all, welcome to Coast. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Shocked. I mean, for a moment, I was reading this going, am I going to be interviewing Dr. Frankenstein for a moment? I mean, it's almost that way where you can bring somebody back who has literally died, can't you?
It really is amazing. And I should be clear, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a hospice doctor. You know, I'm not a cardiologist. I'm not a surgeon. I don't do this. And so I came to this book kind of skeptical, but I came away a real convert. It's amazing what we can do these days.
Dave, tell me a little bit about your background and how you led into this.
Sure. So as I said, I'm a hospice doctor. I take care of people near the end of life. My focus really is on helping people to stay comfortable as possible for as long as possible. And I've always sort of thought of some of the science of resuscitation as being almost the enemy. I mean, I see patients, I take care of patients when resuscitation doesn't work and people come back from the dead with often a profound amount of brain damage, often living in a condition that they wouldn't want to be in. That's what their families tell me. And so I've kind of thought of resuscitation as being the enemy, but I've really realized that we can accomplish some amazing things. And that was kind of why I wanted to write the book, to take a look at the other side.
Now, when you say shocking them back to life, basically, is it because the heart has stopped? It's not because, let's say, they died of cancer or liver failure, or can you still bring one of those people back?
That's really the million-dollar question. Most of the science of resuscitation, where resuscitation, defibrillation, shocking a heart back to life, where that technology works the best, it's in younger patients who are otherwise healthy. In the book, one of the stories I tell is the story of Michelle Funk, who is a 2-year-old who essentially died in a drowning accident. Back in the 80s, she was underwater for an hour, spent another 2 hours without a heartbeat. So for 3 hours, she was, for all intents and purposes, dead. And yet her heart was restarted, she was shocked back to life, and she went on to live a happy and healthy life. That's kind of the holy grail. That's what cardiologists and EMTs and paramedics and surgeons, that's the kind of success story they want to see. And that's what everybody hopes for. It's also possible to restart the heart of somebody with dementia and cancer and peripheral vascular disease and emphysema. But starting the heart in a patient like that is a different ballgame. You can restart the heart, that's relatively easy, but you can't cure all the underlying illnesses.
Dave, when someone dies, obviously the heart has always stopped at their last moment of death there, when they're, you know, their last gasping breath, they're gone. When you have cancer or liver disease or something like that, how does that cause the heart to stop?
It depends. Those are obviously very, very different conditions. Often the terminal, the end event in liver disease is bleeding. Liver is responsible for producing factors that make the blood clot. And often patients with advanced liver disease will have a serious bleeding event. And as people lose blood, their hearts and brains stop functioning. In other conditions like emphysema, often the end result is just a lack of oxygen, getting to all of the organs, including the brain and the heart. So it varies, but in general, the last event usually has to do with a loss of blood or a loss of oxygen or both.
And then they go. Now, let's look at the shocking thing of bringing people back from the death. How much time do you have before you have to do this? Somebody, let's say, dies at 10 o'clock at home, what kind of time span do we have here?
That's a great question. And what kind of time you have depends on, to some degree, how much brain function you want to maintain when that person comes back. You really start to lose brain function after the first 10 minutes or so.
Oh, boy, that's quick then.
It is, and there certainly are extenuating circumstances. So there are patients like Michelle Funk who survived with her brain basically intact after an hour of being underwater, and other people have too. And I tell other stories in the book of really miraculous survival. in situations where either the patient's very young or they were unconscious in circumstances where they were very, very cold, either in ice-cold water or in snow. Cold, we've discovered, is protective. So there are things in the natural world, whether it's a cold water drowning or an avalanche victim, that can prolong that window of time a little bit. But the clock starts ticking really pretty quickly.
So if they're in the hospital and they stop, they die, you've got a better chance to revive them than if they died at home, because I think it would take at least 10 minutes for an ambulance to even get to your place.
That's exactly right. And some of the best survival numbers with CPR come in hospitals, and really some of the best numbers are in ICUs. Although that's beginning to change a little bit. Look around the next time you're in a public place or a shopping mall, airport, bus station, and you'll see these automatic external defibrillators. Having one of those, these are basically shocks in a box, as I call them in the book. These are very low-tech defibrillators that any bystander can use. They don't provide all of the bells and whistles that an intensive care unit has, for instance, but they can restart the heart when it's disrupted by some of the most common rhythm problems.
So maybe every home should have one.
Some people have certainly argued that, yeah.
Does it hurt? You know, what if somebody was just playing around, put the paddles on them, and they're perfectly healthy and shock themselves? Could that kill them?
It could, but if we're talking about the external defibrillators that are deployed in airports and bus stations,
right,
they're pretty foolproof. I mean, they're really designed with drunk teenagers in mind. So the companies who make them make really sure that the device has to sense an abnormal rhythm before it fires.
I saw one on Dr. Oz's show where it talks to you and explains to you what to do, and it controls everything. It was an amazing device.
They really are. I tell the story in Shocked, the book, about going to a simulation center in which physicians were training to use these devices. And even in medical settings, these devices are often programmed to talk physicians and nurses through what to do, because when you're in a code situation and everybody's busy, nobody has time to look at a monitor screen, and so those sorts of verbal instructions really are very helpful.
Give us an example, if you could, Dave, on how somebody died and was shocked back to life.
So one example that I lead the book off with is the example I described of Michelle Funk, who, as I said, was underwater for an hour, mm-hmm. Was pulled out of the water, was brought to the University of Utah Medical Center. Attempts were made to try to warm her because she had been submerged in very cold water for an hour. She was put on a bypass machine to try to oxygenate her blood outside of her heart. She received CPR. She received multiple drugs to try to restart her heart. And then really, for some reason, probably the best explanation was they finally got her temperature up a little bit. It's much harder to restart the heart when the heart is hypothermic, when it's cold. So there's a saying in emergency medicine that you're not officially dead until you're warm and dead.
Yeah, true.
And so one of the first things we do to emergency arrest victims is to try to warm them up so we can restart the heart. But that went on for 3 hours before they were finally able to restart her heart.
Have you ever had someone resuscitated coming back from the dead, but they're almost brain dead? I mean, you find that out, let's say, very soon when they're awake, that there's something wrong here. And then what do you do?
That definitely happens. And I tell, unfortunately, several of those stories in the book as well. So this isn't only a good news story. In fact, one of the patients I took care of early on in my medical school career who made me want to go into hospice and palliative care, I tell the story of a man I called Joe, who I did succeed in resuscitating, me and obviously a team of other doctors and nurses. I was just a medical student back then. But we were able to restart his heart. But he had such bad coronary artery disease and had so many complications during surgery to fix that coronary artery disease that he spent 18 days in an ICU on a ventilator, unable to speak or hear or recognize his family, and finally died on that ventilator.
I'd say, let me go, Doc. Just let me go if I'm going to come back like that. I bet a lot of people would, too.
Many people do. I think the problem is we're getting much better at bringing people back from the dead than we are at having conversations.
Yes, hold on, David. We're going to come back. Dr. Dave Casserette with us. His book is Shocked. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Dave Casserette with us. Shocked is his work. We'll take calls with him next hour, and also stories if you know someone who has died and came back like that. David, let me ask you something that's a little supernatural, and that is, of course, the people that have been shocked back to life, do they ever report seeing anything unusual or what we would always know as, you know, looking at the tunnel with the light or anything like that?
That's a great question. There are as many, I think, visions and stories as there are experiences. I mentioned before I'm a hospice doctor, and in my work as a hospice doctor, one of the things I enjoy the most is talking with people and listening and hearing stories. And that's almost as important, I think, sometimes as what I do medically. And I've tried to put a lot of these stories into the book, Shocked. I've heard many different stories. I will say that many people can't remember anything. That doesn't mean they didn't experience anything, but I think probably the most common story I hear is nothing. The next most common story that I hear, and this is admittedly a not very scientific survey, is a feeling of floating outside their body.
The old astral projection, as we call it, OBEs in my business.
Right. And I hear that a lot.
As a hospice doctor, do you find that people are afraid of dying?
I think many people are afraid of dying, but they're afraid for different reasons. And part of my job as a hospice doctor is to try to unpack that for them. One of the big fears I hear all the time is, to paraphrase Woody Allen, I'm not afraid of death. I'm just afraid of what's going to happen as I'm dying.
Yeah.
Many people are afraid of losing their sense of dignity, losing control, being in pain is probably the most common. And so those are fears that I hear that I can do something about as a physician. Many people I speak with are afraid of what comes next. A fear of there being either nothing, which is terrifying to some people, or a fear of hell for others. But I'm fortunate to work with several chaplains and spiritual care advisors who are wonderful at helping to provide support to people who have those sorts of fears. So yes, I think many people are very, very afraid, but often for very different reasons.
Cryogenics. The great baseball player Ted Williams, when he passed away, his family has his head, just his head, frozen in a cryogenic chamber and enough DNA to maybe clone a body one day. And then their hope is, David, to download his memory from this frozen cryogenic head into the new body. And then you've got Ted Williams again, who hopefully could go on and become another great baseball player. What do you think of cryogenics, freezing the body to such a point and then bringing it back from death?
Well, I guess I would make two points. First of all, it's a long shot. It really is. Based on the technology that we have now, and I spend a chapter of the book talking about cryonics, and actually I spent a weekend at a conference with a lot of people who believe this might someday be possible. Many of them call themselves cryonauts. I think it's really a long shot, and I think we just don't have the technology right now to be able to do any of what people hope. But to be fair, many of the cryonauts that I talked with realized this is a long shot. So I went to that conference thinking I would meet a lot of people who were either not very bright or deluded or were simply in denial. And there may be some people like that, but many people I spoke with realized that, yeah, you know, it's a long shot. Probably not more than a 1 in a million chance that they might actually come out alive on the other end of being frozen. But they say to me, well, you know, 1 in a million chance is better than zero, so why not?
So are they wealthy people? I mean, how much does it cost to cryogenically freeze somebody and then, you know, keep him frozen for so long?
So I think the prices depend on which outfit you go with. I think the biggest outfit right now is a not-for-profit company. I think they're not-for-profit called Alcor.
That's where Ted Williams' head is with them.
And their price right now is for what they call a neuropreservation, or a head, is $70,000, and for an entire body is $200,000. And some people who elect for cryopreservation are rich, but many use their life insurance, have life insurance policies that are large enough to cover
pay that. That's interesting. Wouldn't that be weird that, let's say, 200 years from now, this company, still in existence, finds the technology to bring these dead people back, and all of a sudden, you know, you're not in the year, let's say they died at 2000. They're now in 2200. And, oh, my God, the planet would be so different. I wonder if they'd have a difficult time adapting to that.
I certainly think that I would. I mean, when new technology like Facebook and Twitter comes around, I'm flummoxed for a year or two until I catch up. I can't imagine what it would take to catch up for 200 years of technology.
I mean, Dave, would you want to come back if all your loved ones were gone? You know, your little kids, you know, grew up and died, and you're back 200 years from now? I wouldn't. There's not much to come back to.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would either. I'd rather make the most of this life and do everything I can possibly do, and then a little bit more, and then make sure that I've done everything I could possibly do when the time comes to die. But I think other people really want a second chance.
Do you believe that resuscitation is worth it?
That's a huge and loaded question.
Yes.
And I think it depends on
I'm surrounding
who you are.
I've got a follow-up.
It depends on who you are, I think. And it depends on what your preferences are. You know, I keep coming back to the story of Michelle Funk. I mean, her story was what made me want to initially become an emergency room doctor when I first went to medical school. This is a 2-year-old girl who was essentially dead for 3 hours and was brought back to life. Was that worth it? Well, yeah, she just turned 30,
yes.
I think, recently, just got married. Was that worth it? Absolutely. How could you look at a story like that and say it's not worth it? On the other hand, there's another patient whose story I tell. I went on an ambulance ride with a couple of paramedics who were kind enough to let me ride with them for a couple of days. And with them, took care. They were the ones who were providing the care. I was just a ride-along. But an older woman in a retirement community who they brought back to life and managed to get her back for about a week before she died. Was that worth it? No, not in an objective sense.
No.
And she wouldn't have thought it was worth it either, but they had to do it because somebody called 911. So is it worth it? It really depends on who you are and what your preferences are and what your chances are.
Do some of these people live recklessly? Or do they live conservatively? Do they change their lives, Dave, after they come back?
That's a great question. The people that I've met and talked with, and granted, this is a self-selected group, so these are people who are thoughtful enough to want to talk to somebody who's writing a book. But I have a lot of stories of people who have changed their lives. One who became a minister, had never been particularly religious before, but really saw this as his second chance. somebody else who always made a point of ending every day by making sure there wasn't any outstanding grievance with everybody, wanted to make sure he was on good terms with everybody, friends, family, colleagues, before he went to bed at night. That was his ritual, because he realized that, well, he might not wake up the next morning, and he didn't want to leave anybody angry at him. So there certainly are people whose lives have been changed dramatically like that.
Though your book, Shock, deals with bringing back the recently dead, how far now have we gone with mainstream medicine to preserve people where 10, 20, 30 years ago they might have died, where today things are easy? And I cite the case, Dave, of the great late singer Bobby Darin. He dies at the age of 37. He had rheumatic fever as a kid, damaged his heart. He had bad valves. He ended up dying. He had an operation, never woke up. He died. And that was years ago. Years ago. If he had that same operation today, I bet he would have come through it.
Yeah, I don't know enough details to be able to say categorically yes or no. In general, though, we've gotten very, very good at getting people through difficult surgeries. And what that means is really interesting. What I see, I work at a large academic medical center. And because we've gotten so good at getting people through either cardiac arrest or difficult surgeries, we've become more aggressive at taking people into surgery. There are people now who undergo procedures who would have been deemed to be too much of a surgical risk even 10 years ago. But our technology of bringing people back from the edge of death is getting so good that we're letting people get closer and closer to the edge, not in a bad way. There are surgeons now who are really trying to help people when they would have been afraid to 15 years ago.
Is there a religious application here in Shocked, in that you do bring people back from the dead? Jesus brought people back from the dead. Are you stepping into that kind of ground, Dave?
There are some people, I think, who would argue that EMTs and paramedics and cardiothoracic surgeons really are playing God. I think that's a difficult argument to make, because all of medicine in some way or another is devoted to either providing comfort or bringing people back from the dead, whether that's in an overt, obvious way with a shock to the heart that revives somebody, or treating Ebola virus and curing somebody. Like, that's bringing somebody back from the dead as well. So I don't think we've really stepped into that religious territory recently in a way that medicine hasn't been doing really as long as there was medicine. Although I certainly understand that it can seem that way to many folks.
What, in your work for Shocked, when you were doing the research and subsequently writing it, what was for you, you know, outside of Ms. Funk's return, was the most enlightening aspect of your work?
I was really impressed by a lot of the research that's going on now related to suspended animation.
Uh-huh.
And I bet you anything, when I say suspended animation, that your first thought and your listeners' first thought, as my first thought was, is science fiction, right?
Yes, it's, I was thinking of Star Trek.
Space travel, right?
Stuff like
Star
that.
Star Trek and Avatar, right? You put somebody in a state of suspended animation, and that lets them travel to other galaxies. It turns out, though, that what suspended animation does is it reduces your metabolism, right? It reduces your metabolism to 1% or less of normal. And it, by doing that, decreases your oxygen requirements. And so you can begin to see the application of techniques of suspended animation to a patient who suffers a cardiac arrest, a gunshot wound victim, a soldier who's injured on the battlefield. For all of these people, time is really of the essence, and they're fighting against low oxygen in the blood and blood loss. And anything you can do to decrease metabolism, anything you can do to decrease their oxygen requirements, essentially buys them time. We said earlier that you really have about 10 minutes before you start to see brain damage. But what if you could extend that 10 minutes to 15 or 20 or 30 or an hour or maybe even several hours? That would buy a lot of time for a lot of people to still be able to bring them back without suffering serious brain damage. The science is pretty young, but some of what's going on right now involves cooling cardiac arrest victims or trauma victims to very, very low temperatures. Is really a way of trying to trick the body into thinking that it's in a state of suspended animation. So that's just the first step. But I was really excited about what suspended animation might be able to accomplish in 5 or 10 years.
Well, there's no question if we're going to do lengthy space flights, we may have to do this science fiction type suspended animation, don't you think?
That may very well be true, but there probably will only be a handful of astronauts who wind up going to Mars, and yet there are easily 250,000 people who suffer cardiac arrests every year. So it would be really neat to me if some of the technology to promote suspended animation that might be developed as part of a space program could more in the more near term help some of the patients in our own neighborhoods who have cardiac arrest or soldiers who are being injured on the battlefield as we speak.
How far has science gone into getting us to that point? I mean, is it just starting or is it, you know, halfway there? Where are we?
I'd have to say it's just starting. It's been going on for a while. Even back in the 40s and 50s, researchers in Europe were experimenting with cold, very cold temperatures as a way of reducing the body's metabolism, essentially trying to trick the body into hibernating. More recently, there have been a couple of interesting experiments. I spent some time in the laboratory of a researcher named Cheng Chi Li at the University of Texas in Houston, who's using a compound that occurs naturally in the body called adenosine monophosphate that, at least in mice and other animal models, seems to reduce metabolism very, very quickly.
Is that what the wood frog does? The wood frog literally shuts itself down in the winter. It stops the heart. The heart stops beating. Its blood stops flowing, but it's got some kind of chemical that they put through their system before they go into hibernation.
That's actually very different. What the wood frog manages to do is well beyond suspended animation. Suspended animation is sort of the scientific version of hibernation. What the wood frog manages to do is essentially allow itself to freeze, or it doesn't really freeze. Freezing involves the formation of ice crystals. What it really does is it vitrifies. It manages to cool itself down below the freezing point of 32 degrees.
I mean, it literally dies, doesn't it? The heart stops. It's dead.
It does. It turns into a solid little critter, and the heart stops. It probably does that, it seems, by producing natural antifreeze that's based on glycerol and other glucose-based compounds that prevent ice formation. But it can essentially let itself freeze for a period of a couple of weeks when things get very cold. So that's well beyond suspended animation. But you're right, it's a really, really neat trick. And that's what some of the cryonauts are hoping to be able to accomplish in people.
That is amazing. Just amazing where it's headed and what's happening and how fast it's going. So I would rule out being cryogenically frozen. I don't think I'd do that. I wouldn't mind getting resuscitated if I came to the end. But I don't want to be brain dead. So, I guess there are a lot of factors there, aren't there?
There are. And as we started to talk about before the last break, we've gotten really, really good at bringing people back from the dead. We're not really good at talking about it. Many patients don't talk to their physicians. They don't talk to their family members about what they would want if their heart should stop and what sort of circumstances they'd want to be kept alive in. So information like that, I'd want to be kept alive, but not if I wasn't awake and alert enough to recognize my family. That's one thing my patients tell me a lot. Well, the time to have that conversation is
way before that. Yeah. Exactly. Dr. Dave Kasserat with us. His book, Shocked. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And David, I assume you can get this book, this wonderful book, any place?
You can. It should be available at all major booksellers, including Amazon.com.
Did you have fun writing it?
I was surprised at how much fun I had. And I tried to have fun. I tried to come up with fun stories and talked with engaging researchers and did some fun things. One of the early resuscitation techniques way back in the 1700s was to throw a drowning victim over the back of a horse. And so I decided I would try that just to see what it was like.
That's a long way. We've come a long way. We'll be back in a moment with phone calls.